There was a young man, and this we're starting with a Daryl story. Well, last time I didn't have a Daryl story, and I was kind of disappointed. This time we got a Daryl story, and so it's a good one. It's a good one. So here we go. There was a young man who was an avid golfer. Now, Rick's not here today, and he's not necessarily a young man, but one of the other people in the story could be Rick. All right. Who found himself with a few hours to spare one afternoon, and he figured that if he played quickly, he could get in 9 holes before he had to head home. Just as he's about to tee off, an older gentleman shuffled up to the tee and asked if he could play along. And not being able to say no, he allowed the older gentleman to join him. To his surprise, the old man played fairly quickly. He didn't hit the ball far, but he plodded along consistently and didn't waste much time. Finally, they reached the 9th fairway, and the young man found himself with a very difficult shot. There was a large pine tree directly in front of him and between him, the ball, and the green. Okay. So he's here, the pine tree's there, and the green's on the other side. After several minutes of watching the young man debate how to hit the shot, the old man finally said, "You know, when I was your age, I'd hit the ball right over that tree." With that challenge placed before him, the younger man swung hard, hit the ball up and right smack in the top of the tree. It thudded back to the ground, not a foot from where the original spot was. The old man offered one more comment. "Of course, when I was your age, that pine tree was only 3 feet tall." Thank you, Daryl. All of us in this room have had moments in our lives when we have regretted taking the advice of someone. Sometimes the erroneous advice of just irritating consequences like the young man experienced playing golf. Other times, however, bad advice can cause great harm. For example, you hear from your broker about a great stock market opportunity and you buy thousands of dollars of shares only to have the company do something foolish or the economy collapse and you lose a lot of your money. Perhaps you have had the terrifying experience of having your doctor describe a medication designed to help you, only to discover you've reacted badly to that medication, and the side effects are brutal. It's hard to trust advice, even advice we receive from so-called experts. However we live, we are people with itchy ears, and we long to hear what there is to hear, even if it's not always true. There's an interesting chapter in Jeremiah, the prophet Jeremiah's life, chapter 29 to be exact, which demonstrates our reluctance to accept the truth. Jeremiah had sent a letter to Shemaiah, who was living in exile in Babylon, telling him that God had said that he should prepare for a long exile. Jeremiah told him that God had decided to keep the people of Israel there for many years, and they should build houses and plant fruit trees. And I understand the planting of the fruit trees. I have fruit trees in my yard that have been 10 years old, and they still don't have any fruit on them. So Shemaiah was outraged. He didn't want to hear such talk. Surely God would bring him home sooner. Shemaiah wrote to Zechariah, the high priest, demanding Jeremiah be arrested for writing such a letter. In turn, God gives a message to Jeremiah that Shemaiah has been spreading lies, saying the exile will be brief and Shemaiah will be punished. Jeremiah had authority because God gave it to him, and Shemaiah did not. The point is that even with God given authority, Jeremiah's message was not accepted. The bad news was not wanted, even if it is true. Enter then, if you will, our gospel lesson for today. The setting for this passage occurs the day after Jesus has cleared the temple of the money changers, and also a series of powerful demonstrations of God's mercy in healing people that are sick. The crowds were so overcome by Jesus' actions that even little children were shouting their praises to God. Praise God for the Son of David. The religious leaders of the day were indignant. Actually, that is a mild way to express it. These community and religious powerhouses were angry to the point of trying to dispose of Jesus. Why? Good question. Why did they hate Jesus so much? Could they not see the good he was doing? Actually, that's why they were so angry. Because they could see the good things he was doing and the huge crowds that followed him and praised him. Which seems a little unusual. They were angry because Jesus was the center of attention and they were not. People were talking about Jesus, as in Matthew 21, 10, 11 indicates, and not the Pharisees, the scribes and the priests. The whole city was buzzing with excitement at Jesus' arrival. Also burning the leaders' britches, or getting their knickers in a twist, or how many brothers? I just had them all written down. Anyway, you get the point. Also burning the britches of the leaders was the fact that when people talked about religious matters, they quoted Jesus, not the members of the Sanhedrin or the religious court. The revival of religious fervor originated not from their highly polished and heavenly promoted religiosity, but from Jesus' act of mercy and grace. They were frankly jealous. They wanted the attention. They wanted people to sing praises about them and hang on their every word. Their influence was being dismissed and diminished. The religious leaders must have spent hours debating not only what Jesus said and did, but more significantly, what authority Jesus had to be doing this ministry. It is funny that things were never really change with people. Even today, we are constantly questioning authority. In fact, maybe we question authority more today than we ever have. It used to be when a teacher or a parent or a politician or a minister said something, it carried a lot of weight. Not anymore. Today, most modern people believe that they are their own arbiters of truth. How often have we heard people say, you just don't understand, or what gives you the right? I am sure you heard the expression. Who died and made you king or queen? As the case may be. We doubt the truthfulness of almost every authority figure because we believe that for the most part, they care only about themselves. Never is this more clearly revered than during an election campaign. And some are worse than others. We are very critical about our political system. I once came across an editorial cartoon that portrays our cynicism quite well. It was a picture of a grandmother with her grandchild on her lap reading a book. The child says, Grandma, do all fairy tales begin with once upon a time? And the grandma replied, No, dear. Sometimes they begin with, If I'm elected, I promise to. In Jesus' case, the religious leaders were angry because they were the duly appointed authorities on matters of faith. After all, they had done the studying, the training, and put in their time to be in the position of authority. What, after all, had Jesus done to gain this position? Who was his mentor? Where did he train? He is, after all, just the son of a carpenter. From all places, Nazareth. What gives Jesus the right to clear the temple and heal the sick and make comments on religious matters? This question of authority is at the very core of the religious leaders' objections to Jesus.
He was intruding on their territory and they didn't like it. So this time they go right to the heart of the matter. By whose authority did you drive out the merchants from the temple? Who gave you such authority? They wanted Jesus to admit publicly. He thought God had given him authority, and thus they could charge him with blasphemy and give them further cause to destroy Jesus. In very typical rabbinical fashion, however, Jesus answered their question with one of his own. Did John baptize from heaven, or was it merely human? Jesus was not trying to avoid the question posed to him by a clever turn, but is seeking to reveal the unreceptive hearts of the religious leaders. They recognize that this is no idle question. They have been well trained to know how this rabbinical questioning works. If they say John's baptism was from heaven, Jesus will ask, why didn't you believe John? If they say the baptism was from human sources, the crowds could get violent with rage because they revered John and considered him a prophet. They were caught in their own dilemma over authority. The only answer they could bring to themselves is, we don't know. So Jesus replied, then I won't answer your question either. It is interesting, though, that Jesus does not answer the question, but in a way they did not expect. He uses a parable. In another vineyard parable, and it's straightforward enough, there was a man with two sons, and he asked the first to go out and work in his vineyard, and the son refused. I should point out that this refusal of a father's request was socially unacceptable in Jesus' day. In a family, the father was Lord and Master, and the son's refusal was a great insult. Later, however, the son changed his mind or repented, and he went and worked in the vineyard. The second son received the same request and was all positive about going out, but he didn't go. He said yes, but his actions revealed his refusal to do what his father requested. Then Jesus asked the religious leaders, which of the two sons obeyed the father? And the religious leaders answered correctly, the first, of course. The implication for the religious leaders was staggering. The religious leaders are the second son who received the law and the father's demands. These same leaders gave assent to the laws, agreeing to try and follow them, but they had not obeyed it, nor had they responded to John and Jesus, who have tried to lead them back to the relationship with God the Father. These self-proclaimed faithful religious leaders have fulfilled responding to God's call to service, while tax collectors and prostitutes who originally refused God have repented and now seek to serve him. The sad thing is the religious leaders truly believed that they were doing the right thing. They believed that their obsession with minute details of the law and oppressive interpretations was what God wanted. And I'm sure there are many of us that are in the same situation about rules and not rules and all those kinds of things. But this is what God really wanted. Is ritual and religious works what really warms God's heart? The prophet Hosea's writings include just one of hundreds of verses that speak of what God really wants from us. Hosea 6:6 reads, I want you to be merciful. I don't want your sacrifices. I want you to know God. That's more important than burnt offerings. The religious leaders were truly good at burning up stuff for sacrifices, but really terrible at showing mercy. In their minds and hard hearts, they had written off entire groups of people from any place in God's kingdom. The list was quite long and included, among other things, tax collectors, prostitutes, lepers, those with handicaps, Gentiles, and Samaritans. They had claimed to know what God wanted them to do, but had failed to actually go out and show mercy. Instead of being joyful that Zacchaeus changed his mind about God and wanted to serve him, They stood outside and grumbled about Jesus eating with him. Instead of showing compassion to the woman who broke into Simon the Pharisee's home during the dinner party and poured perfume on Jesus' feet out of gratitude for his love, they grumbled about the impropriety of the woman letting down her hair and wasting money. Instead of recognizing Jesus as the resurrection and the life, who could call Lazarus back from the dead, they laughed at him. Instead of shouting with joy when a poor man in Matthew 12 with a withered hand was healed, they grumbled because he was healed on the Sabbath. As Craig Groeschel puts it, isn't it odd that the Pharisees saw healing on the Sabbath as wrong, but plotting Jesus' murder was okay? Instead of opening their hearts to what John the Baptist was saying in the wilderness, they grumbled about the fact that he was so popular and they were not. So tell me which bothers you more. My greatest fear would be that I'm not the second brother, only giving lip service to the call of God, but not actually engaging in his work. We are always faced with the danger that we can believe we are good Christian people simply because we say the right things or defend what we perceive as a proper Christian position on a whole host of issues. But in the end, words are cheap. Action is what truly matters. This, of course, is one of the main points of the book of James. In James 2:17, we read, So you see, it isn't enough just to have faith. Faith that doesn't show itself by good deeds is no faith at all. It is dead and useless. The second brother may have said he would do what the father wanted, but it was useless when it came to working in the vineyard. What good is our faith if all it amounts to is an hour of worship on Sunday and maybe a few scattered moments of passing along religious sentiments with our neighbors who are in great need of some mercy? We have been shown the way of life, and it is up to each one of us to follow that way and waste no more time harvesting sour grapes. It's not an easy thing to do, but it is an important thing to do.